Welcome to Veterinary Advice, Animal News, and Views, the place for pets and their people who love them.
Aw, he's so soft.
Come here, boy.
Here's your host, practicing veterinarian, Veterinary News Network reporter, and host of the popular YouTube show, The Web DVM, Dr. Roger Welton.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Veterinary Advice, Animal News, and Views. I'm your host, Roger Welton, coming to you from the Florida Space Coast. Thank you very much for joining me this evening. Tonight, I actually have two short topics I want to cover. I know I typically will stick to one, but tonight I've got a couple things I want to talk about, a couple things I feel very strongly about. One of them is why I really feel strongly that people should keep their cats indoors. That's the first topic. And then secondly, I want to talk about anesthesia-free dentistry. There's a new fad out there, and I want to talk about, first of all, is it real? Secondly, is it something that we can really embrace and take advantage of? Because, you know, as it is right now, the way we're doing dentistry is we have to put the patients under general anesthesia, put a trach tube in to protect their airway and, you know, clean away. There's this new fad that I want to talk about, and I've been getting a lot of, questions about and feedback about in terms of, hey, you know, what's this all about? Both in clinical practice and some of the emails that I get from folks around the country. So I definitely want to delve into that and shed some light on it. Excuse me. So we have two email questions, or actually one is a question, I believe, and one is actually a comment. The first question I'd like to address before I get into our topic, and then I'll get into our comment a little bit later. This question was sent in by Kelsey of Omaha, Nebraska, and here is her question. Hello, Dr. Welton. Let me start by saying I truly enjoy your show and have learned a lot from it, not only as a pet owner, but as a vet school applicant. A few years ago, I rescued my polydactyl calico cat, Sophie. Not only does she have quite a few toes, both in the front and the back, her front legs seem to be somehow mutated and are bent to the side at the ankles, which seems to make it difficult for her to walk on hard surfaces and jump up and down from bar stools and such. Anyway, a while back she developed a UTI. UTI, by the way, everybody, stands for urinary tract infection, which we treated. She then had to have some kidney stones removed. As a result, we switched her to KD diet. Later yet, she developed horrible skin allergies on her ears and back, which we have been treating with low-dose steroid shots, which we only do when absolutely necessary. Therefore, the time in between shots fluctuates, but we try to do it every 6 to 8 weeks. Sometimes she seems to go longer between shots and sometimes not. She seems to be feeling okay, but I'm worried about her developing diabetes due to the fact that she's always needing these shots and she is overweight. So I was just wondering if there's another diet I should try to resolve her allergies, but will still be okay for a cat with poor kidney function, or if I should limit the food we do give her. P.S. I don't know if you have already done this, but I was wondering if you could do a show on autoimmune diseases or veterinary ophthalmology, as my pug Gracie seems to have a detached retina as a result is blind in one eye, and my Chihuahua Charlie does not make tears in her left eye and does not respond to Optimmune. So we had the procedure done at Iowa State, where a salivary gland duct is placed in the eye, so now she drools all over her face. Okay, so quite a good-sized question here. Let's address one thing at a time. I'd like to start with the main thrust here, the back leg abnormality, the bending of the ankles. That probably, from what I'm gathering, it sounds like the toes point outward, not quite exactly. Anyway, that's probably an incongruency that resulted potentially from malpositioning in utero, where, you know, she was kind of scrunched up in a certain position and they, you know, just kind of stayed that way. Or it could just be an inherited congenital conformational thing. Either way, you know, when the joints are bent at funny angles, it certainly makes ambulation challenging for some of these patients. And so certainly that's something this kitty needs to contend with. Specifically what to do about it, essentially, you know, we don't like anti-inflammatories in cats, especially this cat who sounds like she's got some compromised kidneys. I would not put her on an anti-inflammatory. I wouldn't risk it. There is one labeled for cats called Medicam, but I've seen two cats go into kidney failure from it. So I don't like anti-inflammatories for cats. In fact, for cats with severe orthopedic disease, I actually would rather go with a steroid. So I see she's been on a steroid for her skin issues. And Kelsey, you do have legitimate concerns with the diabetes. Now, realistically, we find that cats that, you know, go into diabetes from steroid, corticosteroid administration, the general consensus from the internal medicine specialist is that these cats were diabetics in waiting and they were going to end up there anyway. The steroid just kind of sped up that process. Now, given that you have an overweight cat right now, you're right. She has a predisposing factor in place, you know, without the corticosteroid for developing diabetes just because of the fact that she's overweight. And I would think that for the sake of not only helping those deformed legs, but also for the sake of limiting her propensity to become diabetic, I would certainly try to work on that obesity. I really like a diet called Purina DM. DM is a prescription diet that you can get from your vet, and it's basically like an Atkins for cats, but it's not high fat, high protein like our Atkins. It's just high protein, low carb, ultra low carb actually, and I find those diets seem to do best with kitty cats. And so if she's overweight, put her on DM, talk to your vet. DM is a great diet and might get some weight off and decrease her propensity to become diabetic eventually. As far as cutting back on the depomedrol injections, you know, of course, we understand the risk of corticosteroids, and I'm not in any rush to want to be giving regular depomedrol injections. You know, that's a long-acting corticosteroid to any cat, even a thin cat. But you have to trade off, you know, how miserable is she with these skin allergies, and can you have her tearing herself apart at the same time? At the same time, suggestion would be to give some strong consideration to immediately after one of these shots or close to immediately after, put an antihistamine on board. Specifically, I like chlorpheniramine for cats, and you could dose that anywhere from 2 to 4 milligrams twice a day. Chlorpheniramine is sold over the counter in the U.S. under the brands Chlortrimentin or Chlortabs that you can just find in the allergy section of any pharmacy. And you know, antihistamines, once they're in full blown, you know, atopic dermatitis, allergic skin disease, antihistamines typically aren't going to get that in check. But if you get the corticosteroid on board and then, you know, as a preventive measure, put the antihistamine on board, there are a lot of cases that, you know, you can sort of at least decrease the frequency of these steroid injections. Sometimes eliminate them. Chlorpheniramine tends to work very well. But you have to have it on board, you know, when the cat is well. You can't wait until things start to cascade out of hand. So that would be my suggestion. Try to go for that antihistamine while you have an active injection on board. As far as the dog with the parotid duct transposition, very quickly, that surgery is done for a condition called dry eye. Dry eye means that the tear producing tissue within the eyelids basically have crapped out. So the meibomian glands of the eyelids are not secreting adequate tears, and they get this dry eye condition. Most of the time, we can treat successfully with a drop called Optimmune, which will actually reduce inflammation and stimulate tear production in those glands. And when it doesn't work out and it fails to work, one of the alternatives is to have a salivary gland rerouted so that it is actually, or salivary duct rerouted, so it's actually depositing saliva into the eye. And the saliva kind of approximates tears because it has a similar pH. It has lysozyme in it, which is an antibacterial enzyme that helps to reduce infection in the eye. The character is a little different, though. Spit's a little bit more slimy than tears. We know that. And to be honest with you, I've never really seen one of these go well. I mean, granted, yes, the eye is bathed in a fluid which approximates tears, and certainly it helps with that. A dried, desiccated, nasty cornea is not a comfortable cornea. It's not a comfortable eye. But every one of these I've seen, just they end up with this nasty, drooly face, and some of them they actually end up with calcium deposits on their cornea. I'm not a fan of the procedure, to be quite honest with you. My preference would be to continue the Optimmune and just do artificial tears in addition as often as you could. But hindsight's always 20/20, of course. Certainly, there are some vets that will, you know, push you in that direction, and It's not wrong, but not a fan of the procedure. As far as the detached retina, we'll have to cover that another day. But duly noted, Kelsey, I will certainly give strong consideration to doing an eye show and all the things that can go wrong with eyes in dog and cats. And I do appreciate your contribution and appreciate your suggestion. We do have one more comment. I'm going to get to that a bit later. I want to delve into our first half of the show this evening, topic-wise, and that's why cats should be kept indoors. I'm so strongly of the opinion that, you know, that cats should be indoors. I actually think it should be law in every community that if you have a cat, it is not allowed to be roaming outside, and I really think that people should get fined if that cat is roaming outside, and I'm going to talk about why. First off, when we are talking about animals, pet animals, why should anybody reserve the right to let their animal walk all over your property, to go among your children, to interact with your pets? Why is it okay for a cat to be stomping all over your property, defecating all over your property, urinating all over your property? Again, you know, maybe that cat is not as well cared for as I care for my cats. My cats get stool analysis every year. My cats are, you know, free of parasites because of that stool analysis, because I do Advantage multi-topical solution on them every month to keep them free of fleas, parasites, and things of that nature. I do regular examinations on them, and I keep them up to date on their immunizations. Okay, I will tell you from experience that a lot of cats do not receive this kind of care, yet they're allowed to prance all over my lawn, putting my animals and also my kids at risk, and I don't like that. They introduce fleas to my property, and while I do flea prevention in all of my pets, guess what? The fleas have to get on the animal before they're going to die. Nothing repels them, and so what happens? They end up on the pets, and sometimes they can sort of break through that preventive barrier, especially here in Florida. We had an unseasonably warm winter. We had no flea kill-off whatsoever this year, so the fleas have been horrible. And it's going to be made worse with some strange animal who's not well cared for and allowed to roam around. I think it is ethically wrong, all right? Now, why would it be absolutely appalling if I were to let my dogs loose and somebody came out and my dog is on their front lawn crapping on it, right? Wouldn't that neighbor likely be upset if that was happening all the time? Wouldn't that neighbor call up the pound and say, get this freaking dog off my property? That neighbor most certainly would. Most people are not going to want strange dogs around their property. It's just one of those things that, you know, you put it up there with strange people. Yes, I'm in this business to love animals. I'm a veterinarian. I care for them for a living. But I don't want strange animals around my pets or around my family. And I think that should be respected. And I don't think any cat should be allowed to wander around spreading disease, spreading their fleas, spreading their parasites if they're not well cared for. Even if they are well cared for, it's just not appropriate. Strange animals do not belong on my property. All right, so that's consideration number one. Consideration number two is that they wreak havoc on wildlife. All right, and a lot of people think, well, they're cats and they should be out there and they should be predators and they should be allowed to be cats. And that's their thinking process, that letting them out there lets them be a cat and it makes their quality of life better. Well, even if that's true, which I don't believe it's true, and I'll get to that in a little while, what is done to wildlife by cats is completely wrong. So here in Florida, for example, in the community that I live in a very brand new community. It's called Vieira. And Vieira, just 10 years ago, or 10, 12 years ago, was all, you know, pretty much conservation land. It was, you know, marshland, a lot of wooded area. Some of it was ranch land because there's a family here that, you know, owns this gigantic ranch in this area. And so it was decided we're going to build a town here. However, we have a lot of wildlife species here. We have very sensitive bird nesting areas. We want to be able to leave places to live for the gopher tortoises that are an endangered species. We want places for the sandhill cranes. To be able, they're also an endangered species, to nest and raise their young and have a habitat. We also want to be able to have a place for all the rabbits and gophers and every other living creature that called this area home. So what they did was they set up among the communities, all of these preservation areas. And in my neighborhood, there is actually among the community 80 acres of preserve. It's absolutely beautiful. There's paths that go through these preserves, so you can go jogging and running through them. You can take your golf cart through them. And, you know, it's just so nice and pristine. Well, guess what? What happens when people let their cats out and about? Well, the cats say, hot diggity, look at all this hunting ground I have. And they're going to go claim it, and they're going to go wreak havoc on the wildlife that we're trying to conserve. They're conservation areas, and people are letting their cats out, and they're predating on everything. And, you know, in particular, the sandhill cranes are these great big birds. I mean, big, tall birds. They come up to, like, my neck. They're beautiful, docile creatures, but when they have, right now they're raising their young. They usually only have one or two little chicks. And these things are so cute, and they walk around with their parents until they're almost fully grown. And it's an amazing act of nature seeing these things be raised. Well, guess what? Those little chicks, they don't start off as tall as my neck. These little guys start off about maybe 6 inches tall, 12 inches tall, and they are susceptible to predation by felines. And if there are people's cats wandering around out there, guess what? They're going to try to make a meal out of that little sandhill crane. And so this beautiful act of nature that we're trying to preserve, this situation where we're trying to rehabilitate dwindling numbers of a absolutely gorgeous bird that's on the endangered species list. It's actually illegal to mess with these things. You know, people are letting their cat out to have their way with them, and it's just completely wrong. You know, so for the people that sit back and they say, well, you know, it's just the food chain. It's just the food chain. Let it go. No, it's not the food chain. When you actually introduce an animal to an area that was not in that area before, you are not actually going by the normal laws of nature. You are actually putting in an animal that wasn't there, and you're completely messing with what was, yes, a natural food chain. When this was all marshland and this was all conservation area, there were not cats around. And as a result, there was a very delicate balance there where, you know, there's a sort of there was a food chain in place, but it gets completely thrown off kilter when you introduce animals that were not indigenous to an area. So there's a big wildlife concern, little birds that get predated upon. I already talked about the sandhill crane. No place for the rabbits to live safely, okay, because these cats are, you know, obviously devouring rabbits. And it's just wrong. And I, you know, again, I don't want a strange cat on my property. I just don't want it. It's not that I don't like cats. I love cats. I have 3 of my own. So then let's go to the last premise where, oh, well, keeping them indoors, you know, doesn't give them the same quality of life. They don't get to be cats. Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. First of all, a cat doesn't know what it's missing if it never actually gets out there to go act in that way where it can roam, you know, God knows how far, right? If they're confined to a home, then that's all they know, and they're perfectly happy with that. If you create an environment in the home where they have plenty of toys to play with, where they can go vertical, you know, I have one of those, actually two. I have two of those big, tall cat jungle gyms that they can climb up in, and they can lay there in their hammocks, or they can play and bat a ball. There's scratching posts on there where they can scratch. I also have a screened-in porch area that we call them lanais. Here in Florida, other people call them bird cages, but it's a sort of this big screened enclosure that covers your pool so that you can enjoy your pool without getting eaten up by mosquitoes in the evening. It also keeps all the junk out of your pool, and it's a great place to let your cats out, and they can explore, and they can look at the outside, and they can chase birds on the other side of the screen, but they don't touch the birds. And they, you know, we have a lot of vegetation in our lanai. We got palm trees. We got my wife has a tomato garden that she grows in there, and it's just this cool place for them to go out and explore and walk around. And believe me, their quality of life and their level of exercise is just fine. And the occasional lizard does get predated upon by my cats, because you cannot keep lizards out of your lanai. They're going to sneak in some crack somewhere. So they get to chase around those lizards. I'm not exactly thrilled when they catch one, because the little gecko lizards carry a type of tapeworm called Spirometra. But hey, you know what? Life isn't perfect, and if they get an occasional lizard, well, so be it. I'm okay with it. I do test their stool regularly and whatnot. So I really, folks, do not like cats being allowed to roam around. Lastly, it's in your best interest to keep your cat indoors. I mean, it's a family member, okay? It hurts when you lose one of these. It hurts when they get hurt or sick. When you let them out and about, what happens? They get hit by cars. They get abused by people. They get messed up by other animals. And yes, they can get sick. They can pick up nasty upper respiratory and eye infections. They can contract FIV, feline immunodeficiency virus. And FIV, there is no cure for. They have it, they will die from it. And in the process, they could be passing it along to other cats they come in contact with. So you're doing your cat no favors. Just last week, I had a situation where a cat was brought in, 7 years old. The whole family is devastated, from mom to dad to both the children, because this cat was shot with a pellet gun. It was out and about doing its thing because these folks thought it was fine to leave their, you know, let their cat go out, come in at night, have its affection, eat its meal, and in the morning go out and explore again. And that's the way it lived for 7 years. And that's fine until the day some idiot, some jackass in their neighborhood decided it was going to be fun to blast it with a pellet gun. Well, what happened was that pellet pierced one side of its abdomen, went through, damaging God knows what, and came out the other side. And within a few hours, the cat was vomiting blood and defecating blood and was very, very sick and extremely painful in the abdomen. While these owners were in the course of deciding on emergency trauma surgery to bring, to see if I could find the damage and repair whatever may be going on in there, the cat actually went into code blue where, you know, he just basically started to arrest on the table. At that point, I knew that, you know, he had reached the point of no return. Putting him under anesthesia would have been the death of him. He was suffering. He was dying. I recommended putting him to sleep. These people were devastated. They had lost their cat, their beloved companion, a family member, because he was victim to somebody out in the street. Again, some idiot. But the idiots are out there, and it's not an idiot-proof world. And you leave your cat susceptible to that when you let them out there. So much of what I see in general practice when I see cats is the result of the cats going outside, whether it's upper respiratory infection, gouged out eyes, hit by car, torn apart by dog, you name it. I would say probably more often than not I'm seeing cats for stuff like that than I'm seeing for, things that happen that may happen to indoor cats, like, you know, urinary tract infections or things of that nature. And it's a statistical fact, indoor cats live significantly longer than cats that are allowed to go outside. So it's not only in your neighbor's best interest to not let your cat tramp all over their property and decimate wildlife, it's also in your own best interest so you could keep your cat safe, keep your cat happy, and have your cat live a longer life with good quality. All right, so that's my spiel on cats. Going to get into the anesthesia-free dentistry. I just want to quickly go over Amy from Dallas, Texas's comment. This is kind of a short one, and it was really nice to hear. And this is, again, just a comment. It's not a question, but I really wanted to address it on the air because it's always nice when people appreciate various topics that I may cover. Amy from Dallas, Texas wrote this: I found your radio show online and listened to your episode on raw feeding and cannot thank you enough for the solid information. I have been extremely frustrated with veterinarians' approach to this, and you are the first vet that I got some real information from that I could use. Please tell other vets their clients are feeding raw and not telling them because they are afraid to. Thank you again! Exclamation point. She brings up a good point here. Is, you know, when I talked about raw feeding, I definitely talked about there being some level of risk to it. I think the risk is realistically a little overblown. It's just that when you have a bad case of food poisoning, it can tend to stick in your mind, and it can affect your way of thinking a little bit and how you approach a certain paradigm of feeding that some people get attached to. And the bottom line is this, as I said in my talk that day, is the raw feeding, it's not my first choice. I'll be honest about that. I think that it's just not worth the risk, me personally. But realistically, I have to be honest and say, in my 10 years of practice, I can honestly say I maybe have only seen 3, maybe 4 cases of raw food, pathogen intoxication. And, you know, that's if I go back and look at the number of clients that I've talked to that, you know, engage in raw feeding, it's a pretty low number, and you just can't argue with the statistics. So realistically, the risk is low. So what I talked about in that particular episode, and I'm not going to rehash it because I archive my episodes, so go back to that episode and certainly talk about it, you know, and hear what I said about it. But the bottom line is this. Rather than make these people feel bad or guilty about it, which some vets just get so just taken back by the fact that people may feed their animals raw, that they can actually be downright, you know, rude or even disrespectful about it because they're so dead set against it. And so rather than be that way, I simply tell them, look, we're going to agree to disagree on this, okay? As a veterinarian, I must tell you, it's not my first choice. However, if you feel strongly about it, rather than fight with you on this or argue with you about it, let me help you do it right. Let me help you balance out the nutrients, and let's work together on this. And let's talk about how you can minimize that risk, okay? Because you know what? In the end, I think Amy said it quite well. People are going to do it whether they want to, whether you tell them to or not. If they're of that mindset and they want to do it, and they've been convinced, either from experience or from the experiences of a friend or whatever, they're going to do it. And so, you know, arguing with them about it is not the way to go from my point of view. Helping them to do it the best they can is the better way to go. Although ethically, you know, because I have to speak my mind and do say that from a health perspective, I even though the risk is low, I still don't think it's worth it. I let that be said. I let it lie and then move on. Okay, if they still want to do it, I'm there to help them do it. And I'm not going to make them feel bad about it every time they come in my office. And as a result, you know, I have actually picked up new clients that I actually appreciate the fact that I respect their decision. And, you know, it's worked out pretty well. And to be honest, again, it's been a few years since I've had a really nasty food poisoning case. So I think people are doing it better. They're educating themselves better. And certainly you can't argue with the statistics. So let's talk about anesthesia-free dentistry. Hearing a lot about this, especially in the state of California for some reason. And this is basically the premise that there's people out there that say that they can clean your dog's teeth or your cat's teeth without anesthesia. And there's even some YouTube videos out there showing a person doing this with a dog under sedation or a cat under sedation, sometimes without any sedation if they're docile animals. And you can see them start scaling away. And I've actually watched a couple of these. I like to consider myself an open-minded veterinarian, and I want to give everything its due diligence and have a good look at it. I'm also a Veterinary News Network reporter, though, VNN, so I get really objective journalistic stories at my disposal, so I get a lot of information on this kind of stuff. Here's what we found out. First off, the majority of people doing this are not licensed to do it. And that is illegal in any state that I'm aware of. Now, I can't vouch for every state out there, but I do know that in California, where it's being done quite a bit, people are touting themselves as anesthesia-free pet hygienists, dental hygienists. It's illegal. I know here in the state of Florida, it's illegal. These things cannot happen with an unlicensed person. Even a certified veterinary technician here in the state of Florida cannot perform a dentistry procedure without a veterinarian on the premises. So anybody doing this is breaking the law, number one. Number two, not being licensed means that they have not received formal training, and that is a frightening prospect because let me tell you something, scaling teeth is not something that is easily learned. It's certainly not something you're going to learn from a YouTube video. It's not something you're going to learn from Googling it. It's something you're going to learn from actually having classroom work, understanding the dental formulas, understanding the various pockets and what they mean as far as the future of that tooth and what exactly we need to do with that tooth. We also have to be able to recognize, in cats especially, these really different kind of lesions that we see on cats' teeth called cervical line lesions. And cervical line lesions, to the untrained eye, are meaningless, you know. Yes, of course, gum recession and tartar, you know, anybody can look at that and see that. But as far as recognizing a cervical line lesion, I'm telling you, your average person, even many technicians, are not going to notice, excuse me, a cervical line lesion. So cervical line lesions, that's a tooth that is actually actively resorbing. There's a process that's been initiated where a type of cell called an odontoclast has been activated, and they are actually degrading enamel. Those injuries to the teeth are painful. That tooth is dying, and it's going to lead to a future abscess while in the process making the kitty miserable. Those teeth need to go bye-bye. They need to get extracted. And I don't know about you, but without anesthesia, I don't think I'm wanting my tooth extracted. You know, even with all the lidocaine in the world, you got a three-root tooth. I'm telling you, knock me out. I don't want any part of being awake for that process. So that's one problem. These people are unlicensed because realistically there's no veterinarians that are practicing anesthesia-free dentistry. Is it because we want all that money for that anesthesia? Is it because we're dying to put your animals under anesthesia? No. It's because the only right way to do a dentistry and to scale every part of the tooth, all the teeth, to be able to check the pockets. Pockets are separation of gum tissue from the underlying bone. To be able to recognize what's called bifurcation exposure. The bifurcation is the point at which the tooth splits into, you know, two or three roots. If there's exposure of the split where you can put your probe right through that, that tooth needs to go. If there's pockets greater than 5 millimeters deep, that gum is not going to reattach. That tooth is done. We need to extract it. Pockets of 5 millimeters or less, we can salvage those teeth, but we have to do a procedure called a curettage. We have to use this little device where we actually curette the root. So we're going below the gum line and we're scraping the root. Would you want to be awake for that? No. And no animal is going to allow it. So what's happening with these anesthesia-free, quote-unquote, dentistries is you got an unlicensed person using equipment they really should not be using because they've not been trained to use it properly, and they're just chipping away tartar. And you know what? Any layperson could chip away tartar and sit there and just chip away, and just use either a curette or the hook end of a probe to just sit there and scale off the teeth. Well, guess what? The teeth that they're seeing, they're only seeing the outside of the teeth, what we call the lingual surface. Well, there's also the buccal surface, which is in towards the center of the mouth, the inner teeth, so to speak, or the inner portion of the teeth. And how are they going to get to that if they don't have a patient that says, I don't know. So what's happening? They're scaling the part that you can see, but they're not scaling the inner part of the teeth that you can't see. So the owners say, oh, look how beautiful those teeth look. Meanwhile, there is a horrible amount of tartar on the other side that is forming, that is destroying bone, that is continuing the bacterial infection in the mouth. They're just not being done properly. I'm sorry, folks. This is a fantasy. There is no such thing as anesthesia-free dentistry done properly. These animals need to be put under anesthesia for a few different reasons. Number one, we need a tracheal tube in to protect the airway. As we're scaling teeth properly using an ultrasonic scaling device, something that these people don't have, they're just using a hand scaler. We're using an ultrasonic scaling device so that we don't injure the tooth as we're scaling, you know, creating too much heat friction. It sprays a mist of water. Well, we don't want that patient inhaling the mix of mist and bits of tartar and bacteria flying all over the place. So we protect the airway. While they're under anesthesia, we can probe each tooth to see if there's pockets. We can look for cervical line lesions. If there's pockets bigger than 5 millimeters, we extract the teeth. If there's cervical line lesions, we extract the teeth. If there's pockets of 5 millimeters or less, we try to salvage the teeth by curetting the roots, which is a deep scaling, which, again, cannot be done with an awake patient. Case in point, I had to have a deep root scaling because I was not a good patient and I didn't floss as often as I should have. I had to have a deep root scaling. And to do that, they had a nerve block my entire mouth so they could do it. Otherwise, it'd be excruciatingly painful, right? So with the animals under, we can do this all correctly. And we don't have to worry about them biting down on their fingers. And we don't have to worry about a patient who's stressed. When they're under anesthesia, their cerebral cortex is shut off. They are unconscious. For any of you out there who have ever been under anesthesia, it's the weirdest thing. It's like you close your eyes and open them and no time has elapsed. I was once in a 6-hour surgery, me myself meaning, I was the patient, I was a kid, and I'd have a 6-hour long surgery. I had no idea. To me, it felt like I closed my eyes and opened them up. No time had elapsed. But there is my mom in tears, knowing that I'd just gone through a 6-hour surgery. I had no idea. And that's exactly what they feel like. They close their eyes, they open them. They've been through a 45-minute to 1-hour dental procedure that they have no recollection of, no stress over. And they go home and it's done correctly and they have a clean, sound mouth. So it is a fallacy. Don't buy into it. It's dangerous, it's illegal, it's not proper, it's just one of those things that if it's too good to be true, or if it sounds too good to be true, it likely is. So those are my two topics for the evening. That is pretty much it for my email questions and comments. Thank you very much for joining me this evening. I always appreciate the fact that so many of you take the time to listen to what I have to say. Because personally, I don't find myself all that interesting, so I'm glad that you guys seem to like to hear about the things that I like to talk about. Thank you so much again, and I will be broadcast again in probably about 2 weeks. Take care and have a great evening.